Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpilova-Said. I'm delighted to speak today with Keith Liveris, author of Conspiracy Culture, Post-Soviet Paranoia, and the Russian Imagination, which was published by University of Toronto Press 2020. Keith Liveris is Associate Professor in the Department of Slavic and Eurasian Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. He teaches Russian literature, 19th, 20th, and 21st century, culture and cinema. He's the author of Constructing the Stalinist Body, Fictional Representations of Corporality in the Stalinist 1930s, published with Roman and Littlefield Lexington Books. Currently, Keith is working on weaponization of literature and cultural artifacts in eastern Ukraine. Hello, Keith.
Nice to talk to you,
Natalia. Well, thanks for joining me today. So I'm very intrigued by the name, by the title of the book, and outlining the background of your work, you mentioned a few components: conspiracy theorizing, American context, and Russian context. I would like to talk about each of them. What scholarship on conspiracy theories informed your research, and what's the connection between American and Russian contexts in terms of interests in conspiracy theories?
In terms of, you know, what sort of theorizing or theoretical work on conspiracy sort of informed what I do. I mean, I think I can say this probably for anyone who's working on this topic, using the Russian material, that you basically start with the American theory or sort of Anglophone theory. So people like Peter Knight. Peter Knight is a Brit who works on conspiracy theory and who wrote a book. Published in 2000, I think, about conspiracy narratives in the American context. And you basically start out there because there really, up until recently, has not been a lot of kind of sort of theoretical material about the Russian material. So what happens is you use a sort of Anglophone theoretical apparatus. And basically that entire apparatus really comes out of a kind of re-envisioning of conspiracy narratives that occurs around the turn of the century, really 1999, 2000, a bunch of people, Mark Fenster, Peter Knight, Jody Dean, and various other people who produced what I would say is a slightly more sympathetic reading of conspiracy narratives. Sympathetic, not in the sense of endorsing them, mm-hmm. but in trying to sort of flesh out or sort of tease out what conspiracy narratives were attempting to say, what they might speak to us. The alternative, or the what sort of preceded that was I guess what people have now sort of referred to as the kind of pathologizing approach to conspiracy narratives, which starts with Richard Hofstadter's famous essay in Harper's Magazine in 1964. But in any case, these more recent attempts, these sort of more, I guess, revisionist readings of conspiracy theory are all really sort of shaped around sort of the American material. That basically I sort of started out there. I have to say, though, in terms of, in a sort of anecdotal way, in terms of what was the sort of catalyst for my interest in this, It sounds a little strange, but it was partly just the fact that I was running into a lot of people sort of every day who seemed to be sort of invested in this topic. So, you know, I would talk to people who were sort of people, essentially people on the street or friends or friends of friends, who would reveal either immediately or over time that they were sort of amateur conspiracy theorists. sometimes in very strange ways, but so that was, I think that's part of the sort of everyday kind of, I guess, catalyst for my interest in it. Also, of course, I have to mention that I live in Austin, and Austin is the home of Alex Jones. And while not everyone knew Alex Jones, say, 4 or 5 years ago, well, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, they all know who he is now. And he's been sort of talking about these subjects since the mid-1990s, when he was basically just working out of his mother's basement, I think. That was also part of the context. And then the last component of it is, of course, the Russian stuff. And that actually began, I think, with Viktor Pelevin, who is, of course, represents a chapter in the book, right? Because I noticed that that Pelevin was using a lot of conspiracy and occult motifs throughout his work, and still does, actually, up till, you know, the next to the last work of I'm just currently working my way through his last work, Invincible Sun, but yeah, he's still using them pretty actively. And so it started, that was also part of what got me interested in this topic, because I just noticed that it was all over. And then it went from, you know, went from there to other authors like Prachanov, who's kind of the most important, sort of the king of conspiracy, I suppose, in contemporary Russian literature.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that preoccupation with conspiracy theories is not new for Russia, and you mentioned Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Dostoevsky's Demons. You also mentioned other Russian writers, Tucher, for example, to illustrate that conspiracy theory is some sort of tradition, if we can put it this way, in Russia. Would you talk a little bit about how conspiracy theories developed and became popular in Russia?
It depends, you know. Now this depends. I guess it depends on which sort of iteration of conspiracy theorizing we're talking about, or which period. I mean, which you're most interested in. So the most recent period, obviously, is after 1991, right? Or beginning, I guess, in the late 1980s. But if you go back in time, you will see that there are sort of eruptions of conspiracy discourse that occur regularly over time. I mean, you could basically say the same thing about the American material as well. That, you know, people have made the argument that conspiracy, sort of paranoid thinking, goes back to the 18th century, to the beginnings of this country. The Russian material is the Russian context is different, but I think that sort of paranoid ideation, conspiracy narratives of one sort or another, basically shape themselves around periods of what I would call sort of historical, social, political turmoil. That's where we would expect to see them in any case, whether it's in the United States in 19th century, 20th century, 21st century, or Russia in 21st century, 20th century, early 20th century, late 19th century, and then before that. So it kind of depends. It depends on which period you're most interested in. Mm-hmm. But I suspect if you want to find a kind of beginning point, a point of origin for conspiracy theorizing in Russia, you probably would have to go back to the 17th century, so to the time of Troubles. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because it's at that point because of that interregnum, right, between the Rurik dynasty and the Romanov dynasty, because of this sort of immense kind of social, political, economic turmoil that you begin to see probably not the sort of kind of large-scale super conspiracy ideas that we're familiar with, but sort of a kind of paranoia that is sort of shaped around anxieties about the sort of national narrative because of this sort of this extraordinary chaos. I think that really what you're seeing is a reaction to the country's westernization that produces a reaction to this westernization, the westernization that at this point is already beginning, and that produces this extraordinary kind of social chaos and turmoil. So that's probably the point of origin. But then you can sort of point to any kind of historical pressure points over time and see kind of, you know, these periodic eruptions of conspiracy theory, right? And usually in the Russian context, I would say they have to do precisely with the sort of trauma of transition, with westernization. That's why I mentioned Tyutchev. But that's why, I mean, it's not just me, of course, that mentions Tyutchev, but Tyutchev's sort of kind of paranoid ideas about the West are really sort of, I think, conservative reactions to this process of westernization.
Well, I would say that to some extent, your book kind of historicizes this conspiracy preoccupation in the Russian context as well. So, but how would you explain the fact that Russian context appeared rather susceptible to conspiracy theories, while the other, the West in particular, doesn't cease to be viewed as a threat in Russia? You also make references to the...
What did you say? Why the... I just didn't hear what you said. Mm-hmm. Why
the other, the West in particular, doesn't cease to be viewed as a threat in Russia. And you also make references to the current political situation, suggesting that Putin's political strategies, in fact, contribute to the support of conspiracy theories against Russia.
So your question is, I mean, as I understand it, your question is essentially why these theories are so resilient, why the West does not stop being this kind of sort of demonized other that's constantly scheming and attempting to undermine Russia. I mean, this is again a sort of historical question, but I think that I suspect that these are sort of it's a good question. It's also sort of a question that requires, I think, some deep probing. But it seems to me that what you have is a case. What you have is a case of a country that has this sort of kind of long-standing messianic narrative about itself, right? That goes back to really the 16th century, right? The idea of Moscow as the Third Rome, so on the one hand you have Russia with its sort of exceptionalist narrative. But then you have the sort of longstanding kind of conflict with the West, the sort of antagonism, this love-hate relationship with the West, since also probably the late 17th century or earlier, right? And I think it's that sort of contest, it's that sort of sense of one's own sort of kind of exceptionalist narrative, the sort of messianic narrative of Russian greatness, that's constantly threatening to be undone, constantly threatened by the West, and is probably implicit in the sort of ambivalent relationship that Russia has with the, you know, the big other, which is the West. I think that's kind of built into the country's relationship, and so in a sense, you could really say that. Conspiracy modality, the conspiracy mode, is kind of hardwired or baked into Russia's relationship with the West, precisely because there are essentially really competing narratives of national excellence, particularly if you juxtapose the United States with Russia, right? These are two countries that are, you know, sort of notoriously preoccupied with each other. And I think they're preoccupied with each other precisely because they both have these kind of competing narratives of so not messianic necessarily, but certainly narratives of exceptionalist narratives. And to the extent that Russia has felt threatened by the West, for various reasons, this the sense of being of a sort of conspiring other, right, which I think I talk about in the book also, is also kind of baked into the relationship. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of Putin and how this is sort of played out in more recent times, I think it's really towards the end of the 1990s, the early 2000s, that Russian conspiracy theorists and sort of public intellectuals, Ilya Yablokov talks about this in his book, and various other figures, and of course Putin himself, begins to use this idea of the West, particularly the West sort of anchored, tied together with the U.S. This idea, it's at that point that he begins to sort of weaponize this idea of the West that is constantly conspiring to undermine Russia's greatness, or sort of constant, not so much greatness, but collapse the country. It has several different motifs, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. That what you have there, I think, is kind of a sort of conspiracy meta narrative, mm-hmm. That attempts to account for what happened in 1991 and then what happened over the course of the 1990s, and is essentially still a possibility, right? So in 1991, you have the collapse of the Soviet Union, followed by the chaos of the so-called Lihi Divimoste, right? The rough and tumble 1990s. And so around those events, there is a sort of conspiracy narrative that talks about the West, namely the United States, toppling of the Soviet Union, right? We collapsed the Soviet Union. It was done intentionally. And then the sort of an enormous wave of chaos that ensued. All of that, of course, is seen as intentional. Now, the counterpoint to that, of course, is what happens in 2000 with Putin, the beginning of the Putin era, right? But the possibility of a sort of kind of return to that chaos is something that always lingers in the back of the Russian sort of Russian paranoia, I guess.
Well, I have one more question about.
I don't know if that entirely answers your question, but if it doesn't, you just can ask a follow-up.
Yeah, that's fine.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's fine. But nevertheless, I still have one question which pertains to history. So you mentioned some popularity of pseudo-historical works, particularly in Russia.
Oh, you mean like Nikolai Starikov?
Mm-hmm. So would you comment on that? And maybe Maybe we can also compare and contrast with conspiracy theories in this regard in American context.
Well, if you're, if you're asking about, because I think I wrote a bit about Nikolai Stoyakov, right? So Nikolai Stoyakov is this kind of, I guess you would call him a pseudo historian. He's actually very, you know, he's very popular because he shows up on Russian political talk shows. I don't know if you watch any, but I watch them pretty regularly. There's one called The Great Game, Bashai Igra, and then. There's another political talk show. It's really kind of horrible, but it's called 16 Minutes. It comes on every day. And he shows up there regularly. He also shows up on Sunday evening with Vladimir Solovyov. And what's interesting about him is that he really only shows up in his capacity as this kind of, I guess you would call it sort of, you know, a popular historian or a popularizing historian or pseudo-historian, whatever. But he certainly only shows up there in his capacity as a conspiracy theorist. That's clearly why he's invited. And he's written many, many books, really too many to read, published by, I think, Peter, I think is the publishing house in St. Petersburg. And these are sort of popularizing kind of historical works that talk about this sort of essentially, I guess, centuries-long attempt to collapse Russia or dismember Russia or whatever it is. There are a few sort of themes that are repeated over and over, but the basic sort of the basic premise of his works, if you look for a kind of underlying meta narrative, is that there has been that any sort of historical pressure point, any sort of revolution or or sort of revolt, going back to the Decembrist, the Decembrists, I think, is something that has been orchestrated from outside. So is the result of what current conspiracy theorists or would call technologies, right? So there's nothing that happens. There's nothing that happens by chance, and that's I suppose that's that's kind of par for the course for a conspiracy, for the conspiracy modality in general, but. For him, there is no, there's sort of no historical kind of period of turmoil that was not really the project of technologies that were employed by the intelligence services, particularly the British and the American. So whether it's the Decembrist revolt or whether it's the October Revolution, the Bolsheviks, 1991, this is all, these are all kind of iterations of a long-standing project to undermine Russia geopolitically. And so, I mean, in that sense, it's a fairly simple idea that allows for the possibility of inserting kind of new elements at any moment. So, for instance, I think he was on either 60 Minutes or Bashai Igra, the Great Game, fairly recently in connection with events in Belarus and then also Kyrgyzstan. And of course, there the idea was simply to have him occasionally comment on what was an attempt by the West, the United States, and whoever else to collapse the Russian Federation by basically creating chaos throughout the post-Soviet space, so Kyrgyzstan or Belarus or of course Ukraine. So any of these historical moments can be seen as part of this kind of larger long-standing project. And so I was mostly interested in people. I think I mentioned mostly. People like that, and there are other historians or pseudo historians like Oleg Platonov, who writes about Russian Freemasonry, Russian Masons, as well. But I think I was more interested in people like Stoyakov, particularly because there sort of views are pretty pretty well disseminated across the Russian media. Like I said, you would see him anytime there's a kind of need for this particular sort of commentary.
Well, what you just said is very interesting, and it makes me think about this relationship between conspiracy theorists and the state in general, because from what you described, it looks like the state actually supports the dissemination of these conspiracy theories, because all the programs that you enumerated are shown at the stations which support the official programs and the official position of the Kremlin. So, in other words, I can understand why conspiracy theories can be very well disseminated, because they're sometimes easy to understand and it's easy to influence the views of the audience and construct and shape the views of the audience and to translate some sort of official understanding of the events outside Russia as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, in the case of, you know, the state, the Russian state being actively involved in the dissemination, you know, production, dissemination of conspiracy theories, if you think about it, it really makes, there's a kind of logic behind it. And that logic simply is that since the vast majority of Russian conspiracy narratives have to do precisely with this kind of larger geopolitical contest, right? And with a sort of these kind of longstanding fears about the collapse of the Russian state, it does make some sense that you would have the state as an actor that sort of mobilizes them towards its defense, right? Because really it has to do with a kind of core sort of conspiracy narrative in the United States, for instance. In the American material, there isn't an equivalent. The shape of the conspiracy narrative is different. It has much more to do with individual agency for the most part. Although there are many variations on that, but in the Russian case, I mean, it's definitely mostly about threats to Russia as a state. I mean, we see that, for instance, throughout Brakhanov's work, right? And so it does make some sense, I suppose. There's a kind of logic to the fact that that you would have this sort of large-scale official weaponization or mobilization of conspiracy theories. And of course, I mean, we know that through in the 1990s and then the 2000s, it was public intellectuals who were at the forefront of weaponizing or implementing or utilizing conspiracy theories. People like Brakhanov or Dugin, for instance, are sort of the point where that starts. There was something else I was going to say, which is a response to something you said, but I forgot.
Mm-hmm. So for your book, you use quite a various cultural material to illustrate how the conspiracy theories are either disseminated or what kind of artistic form they may find either in films or in novels. So you did mention Pelevin, but you also analyze Bakhman Bedov's films as well. And in one of your chapters, you mentioned Stephen Norris's explanation of the film's success. It said the following: they seem to speak directly and forcefully to the Russian soul. So I guess one of my questions will be, what's the Russian soul in conspiracy theories?
What is the Russian soul in conspiracy theory? Well, that's an interesting question. I think now sort of we're kind of shifting gears a little bit. So the Russian soul, I think that the easiest way probably to say that, I don't know that it necessarily applies to the two films by Bakhman Bedov. Maybe we can talk about that separately, but I think that if we're talking about some of these cultural artifacts, the Russian soul represents or threats to the Russian soul, let's put it that way, are a separate subset of these within the sort of conspiracy narrative. So you can talk about sort of geopolitical conspiracy stories, which are the ones that deal with threats to the Russian state, fragmentation or collapse or whatever. The many of the conspiracy theories that came out of 1990, what happened in 1991, and the rough and tumble 1990s. But then there's a sort of special subset, which I think is a very significant one, and that is threats to the Russian soul, right? I'm trying to figure out how the best way to describe this is. I mean, I think that unlike, for instance, in the American material, there has been over time and continues to be a sense that part of the sort of threat to Russia's greatness is a threat to its sort of cultural potency. And I think that's one of the points that I try to make, that I make really repeatedly in the book. That is, it's a threat to sort of Russian spirituality, which is one of the, one of the culture's biggest assets and best-selling assets, right? If we think about Russian culture, we think about Russian literature, we think about Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and many others. Tyutchev is someone who comes up in this context. There's a wonderful anecdote in Viktor Pelevin's Homo Sapiens, which is Generation P in Russian, which involves a vodka advertisement for Smirnoff vodka, it quotes basically, it's a quote from Tyutchev, which has to do precisely with sort of Russia's spiritual exceptionalism. That you can't understand Russia with the mind, that Russia can only be believed in. Well, so in this particular episode in the novel, you have this advertisement for Smirnoff vodka, and that famous phrase is rendered in a kind of semi-literate Latin transliteration. And what's interesting about it, from the standpoint of this idea of the Russian soul, is that Tyutchev here represents the mysteriousness, the mystique of the Russian soul, right? But in the book, it's something that basically becomes a sort of advertising gimmick. And that is one of those sort of kind of funny anecdotes in the book that really sort of exemplifies, I think, a kind of almost universal Russian fear, and not just about commercialization or commodification, which is sort of the thematic heart of this book, but about this sort of kind of large-scale threat to Russian, the sort of narratives of sort of traditional narratives of the Russian self, right? Russian spirituality, духовность. And this is something that comes up over and over again as a sort of part, as a sort of component of this conspiracy against Russia. In other words, how do you go about collapsing a country? Well, I mean, there are multiple ways that you can do that. I mean, there are sort of there are geopolitical technologies that can be used, but you can also sophisticated methods or more sort of specific methods. In this case, it has to do with a corruption of the sort of core kind of story of self, the sort of core Russian narratives, and that has to do with spirituality. And so if you look, for instance, at Pelevin, that's one of the things that keeps coming up again and again. Well, in this novel in particular, but it's really about it's about a corruption of the Russian soul, about erosion of Russian spirituality, and an erosion of cultural potency. That's one of the sort of the most kind of poignant fears that's evoked in this novel, is sort of a collapse of what Pelevin talks about as eternity. But it's pretty clear if you read. If you read that novel closely, that eternity there is simply a metaphor for this sort of larger universe of kind of spiritual signifiers. Now, if you look at another writer like Prachanov, he talks about it as duchovne smysly, so sacred signifiers. So part of this battle that is being waged between Russia and the West has to do with the West's attempt to undermine the country's sort of spiritual signifiers, so to speak, right? So it's kind of cultural, sort of deep spiritual values and narratives. And what's interesting about, I think, about the Russian, what's truly interesting about the Russian material is the degree of preoccupation precisely with that. Because you wouldn't see that in the American context. It's simply not there. There are other things that we're anxious about, but it's certainly not cultural artifacts and not not these sort of spiritualizing narratives. Now, a good example of this, actually, which I think I also mentioned, has to do with Pussy Riot. The reason that it's a good example is that most people, when they think of the Pussy Riot punk prayer, right, they think of it, most people in the West, I suspect, think of it as an instance, as having to do with sort of freedom of expression, artistic freedom, et cetera, et cetera. That's how it's perceived here. But in Russia, it was really perceived very differently. It was perceived because there was this sort of very elaborate conspiracy narrative that arose around what happened in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior. So, and that sort of conspiracy narrative had all these components, but basically it sort of boils down to an attempt, again, orchestrated, choreographed by the West, by the United States or Canada or whoever was involved, to sort of corrupt sort of erode people's faith in the Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox Russian Orthodox Church being a pillar of Russian contemporary Russian identity, not just contemporary, obviously, but so again, a kind of weaponized threat directed at the Russian soul.
So the corrupting force is outside Russia.
Not erupting. I mean, erupting is probably not the right word for it. So it's a technology.
Corrupting. I meant corrupting force.
Oh, corrupting. Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, the idea would be that if you can't collapse a state for obvious reasons geopolitically, so you go the next best thing is to sort of corrupt its moral architecture. Mm-hmm. And in the Russian case, how do you do that? You do that by kind of striking a blow at the Russian Orthodox Church. And that's exactly how it was portrayed. And that, I think, is a good example of it, simply because, you know, again, if you sort of contrast that with a Western perspective, I really don't think anyone would quite understand what that was, why that seemed particularly threatening. But it's really about an attack, or is perceived as an attack on the sort of sacred space, right? And that if you manage to sort of erode or corrupt that sacred space, that is what will allow you to sort of collapse the country in a more direct way. It does seem a bit exotic, I suppose, but it's not, it's certainly not unprecedented. I mean, I talk about Dostoevsky's Demons, right? Which involves a conspiracy, right? Although in this case, mostly imaginary, since there aren't very many members, of the conspiracy, except the ones who were participating in that provincial town. But there too, what's interesting about this conspiracy is precisely that it's a conspiracy that's directed against the, I'm trying to think of a better word for it than spiritual signifiers, but I can't really think of one. So the sort of cultural, the sort of deep cultural spiritual underpinnings of Russia. And that's actually what produces the conflagration at the end of the novel. I mean, the fire, I mean, the husband, the governor von Lemke says, I think, the fire is in the minds, right? It's a conflagration that occurs in people's mental space, And it's one that comes about because of this sort of corrupting of language that we see, you know, that sort of played out throughout that novel. That I think is a sort of typically Russian, and one of those things that's also quite that seems quite exotic from a Western perspective. It's not surprising, and I bring this up in the book. I can't remember who it was, an Orthodox priest who wrote about the Pussy Riot affair and who brought up demons as sort of, you know, kind of foreshadowing something like this, or as, you know, kind of illustrating exactly this kind of sinister attempt to undermine Russia's spirituality. So the Russian soul, strangely enough, is at the heart of this anti-Russian conspiracy, this Russophobic conspiracy.
Well, your comments made me think about censorship. Censorship that goes back centuries and centuries ago, but I'm particularly interested in the 19th century. And yes, I absolutely agree with this statement that when we read about Russia, or first of all, we think about Russian literature and Russian spirituality. However, it looks to me that Russian spirituality was very much institutionalized, and I would say instrumentalized, particularly in the 19th century, when Russian spirituality was used by the state to actually describe this messiah mission, so to speak, for the entire world. So I'm going back to our conversation about corrupting and corruption and corrupting force. And what you just said about this very I would say complex relationships between Russian contexts and the contexts from the outside make me think about as maybe self-corrupting to some extent.
It depends. I mean, self-corrupting. The problem is the sort of reality versus what we're going to see in the conspiracy narrative. And of course, in the conspiracy narrative, in any sort of normative conspiracy narrative, the corrupting force is always something that's external to the self, right? Now, whether or not that sort of, it's a good question. I don't exactly know the answer to that, but I may not have necessarily understood your question either. In other words, you're asking, you know, whether the state itself has not undermined Russian spirituality. I suppose yes, and that's something that is sort of a long-standing issue, certainly since the reforms of Peter the Great, I suppose, right? Since the undermining. Not undermining, since the institution of the Holy Synod under Peter the Great. So I don't know whether it fits naturally in the kinds of conspiracy narratives that you would see. Whether objectively the Russian state has not in multiple ways undermined itself. I mean that's a completely different topic, I think. But I can tell you that it never really figures in any sort of conspiracy story.
Do you have a chance to teach this topic to your students?
I do. Yes, I'm doing it right now. Although it's a conspiracy course for freshmen, and so we haven't really gotten. I mean, we're just now reading. We just now started reading Homo Sapiens. We read Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I hadn't read. I mean, I hadn't read in a couple of years, and I'd forgotten how atrociously it's written. It's an interesting conspiracy narrative, but the actual style is horrific, and so. It was a bit hard to get through, but yeah, we just started Homo Sapiens, and we talked about the 1990s and right? And the collapse of the
city. What are students' responses to this material?
Well, this is sort of in general. Everyone, students are sort of familiar with it because conspiracy stories are everywhere at this point. I think it's the same response that most people have, and that is, why is it that they're so paranoid about attempts to sort of collapse the Russian state? Because conspiracy stories that they're familiar with are really more about the sort of erosion of individual identity. Maybe it's changing a little bit because of Trump during the Trump era, and then also this kind of preoccupation with spirituality, why that is so important. That I think is really, that I think that's what they usually say. And they also say, one of the questions they regularly ask is precisely the question that you, is sort of a variant of what you're asking, and that is, are there Russian conspiracy theories that deal with, that are more internally focused, that look at the Russian government as a conspiracy actor, as the originator of conspiracies? And that, I think, is the most exotic thing for them, because it's always the first question. Where are the conspiracy theories that are analogous to the ones that we know, right? Mm-hmm. And there just aren't that many. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's strange to them, mm-hmm. this sort of sense of Russia as this kind of besieged, embattled fortress nation that is being, that is being targeted from outside.
Can conspiracy theory or theorizing be normalized, and can it be presented as an essential part of the worldview construction and absorbed in the cultural and political dimensions of the country? Because from what we were talking today about, conspiracy theory is something, it's something additional, it's something there, and we may consider it, but however, there is always this kind of note that it's a conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm. So can it be normalized? Can it become part of the sort of everyday functioning, or sort of our everyday functioning? I think that, the simple answer to that is that it has been. Mm-hmm. Now, the examples that people are going to be most familiar with are the ones that reflect our own experience. I mean, we've seen, in this country since 2016, because Trump sort of allied himself to people who are conspiracy theorists and became a sort of proliferator of conspiracy theories, that in fact they have been normalized. They were sort of outliers. They were marginalized before 2016, but they are no longer as marginalized as they were before. And I don't think there's any way to put that toothpaste back in the tube. So once they have become mainstream, and they already were sort of mainstream, but in terms of popular culture, so it's very difficult to restore appeal to some earlier ideal or time where they were actually sort of marginal. They absolutely can, and they can be sort of utilized by people in power. Obviously, we've seen that here. We saw it in Russia long before we saw it here. So in Russia, certainly since 2000, and they became part of sort of public, this kind of large scale public narrative. We were kind of, late to the game, but they absolutely can. I would expect, I'm sort of following events here pretty closely, and I thought it was pretty interesting that people at least one person who's a sort of QAnon conspiracy believer is now in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So Marjorie Greene from state of Georgia. I think we probably can assume that they are going to play a larger role in the public space. Now in Russia, there's no reason to assume that would diminish, especially since they've essentially employed kind of paranoid ideation or sort of ideologies or their conspiracy narratives so effectively as a means of generating social cohesion. I mean, that's one of the things that they're particularly effective at doing, right? Because you have this juxtaposition of an embattled self and some sort of kind of sinister plotting other. There's no reason that they would, I think that they would scale any of that back. Again, in Russia, they are so much a part of the sort of kind of political rhetoric. And everyone really uses them to some extent or appeals to them, sometimes with a wink and a nod. I mean, for instance, on these political talk shows, you see people who may themselves not be particularly sort of, they may not be conspiracy believers, but they invite people like Nikolai Stadikov and other sort of conspiracy adepts onto their show, and they will occasionally reference sort of conspiracy ideas themselves. Mm-hmm. Solovyov does it pretty consciously. I mean, Putin has also used them, pretty, or sort of, at least referred to them. In fact, very specific conspiracy memes. There's no reason that they, I mean, there's no, I don't think there's any reason to expect that we'll see them being rolled back. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're asking, because they've been very effective. I mean, now here, it's maybe it's a little harder to say because we have a new president, right? But the question is, is that really going to make a big difference in terms of the sort of rhetoric that's out there? And I suspect that no, because as I said, once you've sort of let the genie out, it's very difficult to kind of claw back that situation before.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
I wish I could be more optimistic or more, provide more hope. But I just think that there's no reason to think that we can somehow reverse this trend, and particularly not in Russia. I mean, we know that there. I mean, I think there was a poll that was done in 2018. I think it was a fairly reputable poll, and basically what they said, or the result was that like 66% of Russian citizens believe in some attempt, some sort of anti-Russian, some sort of Russophobic conspiracy, which included, among other things, an attempt by the West to undermine Russia's historical greatness. So some sense of, basically to sort of undermine what Russians kind of universally accept as a sort of exceptionalist narrative, but maybe messianic narrative is a bit much for the everyday person, but some sort of exceptionalist story sort of Russian history. And I thought that was kind of interesting as well, that a significant part of that was, was a conspiracy, a conspiracy threat that was aimed at Russia's historical greatness.
Yeah, we didn't talk about the Soviet era, unfortunately. But I think the conspiracy theory was quite popular during the Soviet era as well. And it also contributed to the support of its popularity today as well. However, unfortunately, we're running out of time. But however, for some reason, conspiracy theory turned out to be still popular for Russia, but not that probably popular for other post-Soviet.
I was actually thinking about that. And I think that, you know, the reason for that is precisely, I mean, again, I think it goes back to these, you know, these sort of messianic narratives. And you know, since Russia has essentially perceived itself, its own greatness in the world, its own, you know, the sense of Russia as a Velika Derzhava, I mean, stems from this, you know, centuries-long tradition of messianic thinking, which is then, you know, which has many different iterations, but in some sense always comes down to this idea of Russia, of Moscow as a third Rome. I think it stems or sort of has to do with precisely that. And if there isn't that sort of an exceptionalist story, then it becomes very difficult, or you're not as inclined, perhaps, to this kind of sort of paranoid thinking. That's sort of my gut level sense about it. I mean, you know, Russia, I mean, Ukraine, Belarus, there just isn't any, for obvious reasons, there isn't any tradition of that. Mm-hmm. And so there's no sense of oneself as being a sort of target in the same way, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Keith. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. And thank you for the book, which help us better understand not just the cultural dimension of Russia, but political and social as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Today I spoke with Keith Liveris, author of Conspiracy Culture, Post-Soviet Paranoia and the Russian Imagination, published by University of Toronto Press in 2020.